Hello and welcome to another episode of Enginerds, a monthly podcast about all things engineering, coming to you from Northumbria University, Newcastle in the UK. My name is Nick Martin and I'm sat here with fellow Enginerds, Madeline Conbrink and Craig Warren. On this episode, we're going to be talking about flying pumpkins and we'll discover what GPR stands for. So this week, since we're running a special Halloween episode with one fact that's Halloween based, we'll kick things off with Madeline, your fact.
Yes, so the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA is not only good at building rockets and sending things to space, building Mars rovers, but they are especially good with carving pumpkins. So it turns out for the last 7 years, they've had a pumpkin carving contest around about this time of the year. But being engineers, it has a little bit of a swing to it because they're not only carving the pumpkins, but they're coming up with some really interesting designs for it.
Yeah, I mean, we'll definitely put a link to some of the videos and like to the kind of the website where they've got some of the pictures, because really they are quite fascinating, some of the designs that they've come up with.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way we can do justice to describing them without the pictures and videos, because there's some phenomenal efforts.
but think of this, if you take a whole group of rocket scientists and you tell them, here's a pumpkin, do with it whatever you want to, there's a whole lot of interesting things that comes out. The one that caught my mind, sight the most, was the one that had the first place last year, and that was a celestial pirate ship that sailed past Jupiter on an ocean of dry ice. So they actually used a pumpkin, made a ship out of it, have a bunch of planets in there somehow, and they made it sail past the planets. Then there's some other ones where they call it a shy pumpkin, it can turn off its lights. So the pumpkin is fitted with light sensors on in different ways, and it can switch on and switch off its own lights, but it's not normal lights. It's really like this eerie, blue, evil kind of light that radiates from the pumpkin. The one that I like most is the hovering pumpkin. They took a pumpkin and attached a parachute to it, had a leaf blower below it. Oh, and this wasn't any pumpkin, this was a Frankenstein pumpkin. And they actually let the pumpkin hover above the ground.
Amazing.
So, I mean, that, they're all incredible. And the hovering pumpkin was also my favourite because it utilises a particular aerodynamic effect called the Coander effect to hover. So, I don't know, you can try this at home actually. If you have a ping pong ball and a straw, then you blow out through the straw and put the ping pong ball above where you're kind of blowing out through the straw into the jet of air, and it will hover above the jet of air because of this Coander effect.
There's another way in your kitchen that you can illustrate that, and that is if you have a spoon and you hold the spoon underneath a running tap.
And the water kind of... Yeah, the Coander effect means that the water gets diverted along the back of the spoon.
Yes, instead of going directly through the spoon or down the spoon. But something that is also very interesting here is I was wondering, okay, so what are their specifications? Because if you have a contest, for instance, we had the Derby last year and we didn't give them a pumpkin, but we gave them a block of wood. They had to build a car out of this. So what do they get? What's the rules? And what they get is a pumpkin, that's about it. And the rules are simple. No planning, carving, or competing during working hours. And for the rest, anything goes.
I thought it was... Isn't there a 1 hour time limit on the actual carving of the pumpkin?
Yes.
Yeah.
But all of the all of this happens in their lunch hour.
Right, yeah. I mean, they're busy... engineers at JPL, they don't want to like take any time out of their actual working day, obviously.
Yeah, sorry, the Mars rover has been delayed because we were busy carving pumpkins for for a week.
Or oops, the calculations was wrong and we blew up a space shuttle. because we were busy carving pumpkins.
Can I jump back for a minute? Because I'd never, like the Coander effect that you talk about, that rang a bell for me, but it rang a bell for me in your particular area of expertise, because I only remember hearing that word in relation to, I think it was exhausts, was it not? On Formula One cars.
Yeah, so Formula One cars, you use this effect by, they kind of, In before the new set of regulations came in, so a couple of years ago, the bodywork at the back of the car was angled down towards the diffuser, and then the exhaust channels were then kind of directed over the back of the bodywork, and the Coanda effect basically was the curvature of the bodywork, which pulled the exhaust gases down into the diffuser to give you more effectively more momentum down there to improve it. Yeah, improve your downforce. And
that's interesting, because as I say, that was the first place I'd heard it, and I hadn't related it to the kind of the simpler concepts that you both kind of illustrated earlier.
Yeah, so we'll put a video in the show notes, but I found a video on YouTube of a guy levitating various things inside an Airstream, and it was incredible. Like, it goes on for quite a long time, actually. It's about 15 minutes of him just levitating different things.
Well, I think that's what an engineer is about, just doing random weird things for 15 minutes at a time.
Well, once you get excited by one kind of concept, you want to see how many different, you know, things you can apply it to. So I guess that's what you kind of, you know, think, oh, I can do this with this particular object. What else can I do?
Do you know what the pumpkin chucking, which is an American phrase for throwing, world record is? So how far a pumpkin
is there? Is there like a standard pumpkin size for pumpkin chucking?
Well, it has to be able to fit. In this case, we're not talking about human powered pumpkin throwing.
Oh, I see.
About machine powered, and in this case, it had to fit inside a 10-inch barrel of this crazily big compressed air gun that they used to fire
pumpkin cannon.
Yeah, basically a pumpkin cannon.
I love it.
I don't know if that's the only thing that they were firing out of this cannon, but. But it currently holds the record.
I'm going to say like
20 metres.
No, 100 metres.
You're both miles off. Literally, it's 1.4 kilometres.
Wow. Okay, but now I have a question. Was the pumpkin frozen?
No.
That's impressive. Yeah. That's extremely impressive.
So before you steal my one and only pumpkin fact, because I imagine you have it there somewhere, do you know what the world record is for the heaviest pumpkin?
I mean, I do, but I'll see if you can guess it.
Okay, so I would guess 500 kilograms.
No, you can double that and add a bit more. Yeah. So it's 1,190.5 kilograms. It was grown in Germany in 2016.
Was it Germany or Belgium?
Oh, controversy. Oh. Well, I thought it was German, but okay. I'm intrigued to know how long does it take to grow essentially a one-ton pumpkin?
Yeah. How did they weigh it?
I don't know. On the official Guinness Book of Records pumpkin weighing scale.
What's interesting is before, so there was that record, and then the previous world record was held by someone in Switzerland, or it had been grown in Switzerland. And all of the previous attempts before that were in the US.
Mm.
But it seems as though Europe has finally taken back the trophy. Back in like the kind of early 70s where they started doing this, the weight was around about just under 250 kilograms. And the increase is actually exponential. And so if you extrapolate the data, by 2050, we'll probably have a pumpkin record that's over 4 tons.
Wow. So like a small truck, essentially.
Since we're talking about Halloween-related pumpkin things, and we're talking about pumpkin flying, this is a very tenuous link. Has anyone heard of the pumpkin fly?
No.
As in the insect?
Yes.
I have a particularly gruesome fact relating to that. So the pumpkin fly is a pest effectively, that eats pumpkins. Well, specifically lays its kind of eggs inside a pumpkin. I don't know if eggs is the right word, but anyway, the larvae of the pumpkin fly hatch out inside the pumpkin from when this pumpkin fly has done whatever it needs to do to do that. I'm not a biologist. Farmers Weekly was talking about various methods for getting rid of these things, and I'll quote from them directly. So, according to Farmers Weekly, one should leave an affected pumpkin in a clear bag to cook the maggots in order to dispose of them.
That's presuming that you have sunlight.
Oh, yeah. I mean, leave it in the sun.
Okay,
yeah.
Leave it in the sun. So it's not going to work here.
We have to totally not cut any of this out. To have a quote from Farmers Weekly
on our podcast. Why are you reading Farmers Weekly?
It's like, you know, it's like a Viagra News for You, where they have like, you know, the guest publication this week is like, you know, Rigid Inflatable Boats Monthly. So for me, the pumpkin carving is a bit strange because, and I don't know if it's just a Scottish thing, I think possibly Irish as well, but we would always carve turnips. So I think the pumpkin thing was more of an American custom. But growing up, yeah, we would do the same thing, but with turnips, which, as I've discovered, is much harder than pumpkins. Yeah. Trying to hack out the inside of a turnip is quite a dangerous activity.
I mean, turnips are pretty solid. Like,
yeah, you can see why parents kind of, you know, flinch at the prospect of giving their children the right equipment to hack a turnip to pieces.
I won't. This podcast isn't sponsored by Asda, but if you go to Asda for this particular Halloween, you can buy a pumpkin, and you can also buy pumpkin carving tools. So they have like specific tools. And actually, in the JPL video, you can see some people using various different tools for carving pumpkins. And obviously, because they're engineers, they're using like Dremels and like specialist saws and stuff. It's really quite incredible.
Is this like, you know how you can get like a special knife for like cutting grapefruit? Is there like a special kind of, is this the equivalent sort of pumpkin carving?
Is there a grapefruit knife? Is
that a thing? I'm just as surprised that's a thing now.
Man, you guys have not. What kind of?
I know about the grapefruit
society. Have you been living in
spoon?
It's like grapefruit spoons. Knife has like a one end of it is sort of curved and serrated on both sides. It's about this long, so you can, when you slice your grapefruit in half, you then cut with one end of the knife, looks fairly normal, you cut the segments, and then this curved end, you go around the curvature of the grapefruit to loosen all the segments up.
Maybe for our foreign listeners, we should describe a little bit more about what the origins of Halloween are.
So I only know a little bit about this. From what I understand, it was originally an Irish kind of legend, I guess. Would that be the right way of describing it? And the legend has it that there was this person called Stingy Jack.
Right.
Apparently the story goes that this person called Stingy Jack persuaded the devil to climb this tree. And the devil climbed the tree, and whilst he was up the tree, Stingy Jack put crosses under the tree so that the devil couldn't come down. And he made he said to the devil, well, I'll take these away if you promise me that I'm not coming to hell when I die. So the devil duly said, well, okay, I'll do that. And so he came down. And then when Stingy Jack died, he went to the pearly gates and was turned away because he'd been really mean. And then when he went to try and, you know, go to hell, the devil said, well, sorry, you know, you made me promise that you couldn't come here. So he was stuck in the darkness between heaven and hell.
Isn't that a bit called purgatory?
Purgatory, yes, I think so. And apparently the devil handed him this, turnip that he carved into a lantern so he could see in the darkness.
Right.
And he became known as Jack-o'-lantern.
I see. There we go.
So yeah, that's apparently where it comes from. I don't know where the... Now, Halloween, the word is...
Halloween is actually from a Catholic origin. So the old Celtic New Year used to be on the 1st of November.
Mm.
And the Catholic Church renamed that All Saints Day, or All Hallows Day.
Yeah.
And therefore the 31st, the day before, was then known as All Hallows Evening, or Eve. And then hence the correct spelling for Halloween is Hallow WE'EN, because it's a contraction of All Hallows and Evening.
Yes.
And that's where the word comes from anyway.
So now we've covered Halloween and where pumpkin carving comes from.
There we go.
Facts.
Yeah, a slight divergence from engineering to religious history, but you know.
But you know what? If the people from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory can take some time to carve pumpkins, we can talk about pumpkins. We can talk about
them as well. Exactly. All right, it's time for our next fact, and that is my fact, and that is that Teflon makes it easier to spin wedding rings. And there's a bit of a backstory to this fact. Well, there's kind of two backstories. Firstly, my wife gets really annoyed with me because I'm forever taking my wedding ring off and spinning it on like a tabletop. And it's just one of those annoying
habits. I'm glad to know that someone else does this because I also do this. And there have been several risky, dangerous moments that have occurred as a consequence of it.
You mean where you've almost lost your wedding ring?
Yes.
Yeah. Same here. But the other kind of, well, the other backstory really is that there's a TV show in America called The Late Night Show, hosted by Conan O'Brien. And he, live on air, during the 2008 US writer's strike, when they were kind of running out of material, decided to spin his wedding ring on this kind of table in front of him, live during the show. He was trying to beat a previous record that he had for the number of, like, how long basically he could spin the wedding ring for. His previous record was 41 seconds, and on that particular show I think he managed 36 seconds. And in a later episode he got a physicist to come in to basically talk about, you know, how to extend the spinning time. And yeah, so anyway, that's kind of what the fact's about. And the link to Teflon is that basically if you can reduce the friction between the surface that you're spinning your wedding ring on and the wedding ring, then you can improve your spin times. And they didn't use Teflon actually on the show. They used Vaseline, which they put on the surface to kind of make it more slippery, I suppose.
Mm.
And they managed to get, on average, a 10-second improvement in spin time.
I feel like you're going to relate this to something more useful than spinning a wedding ring. But...
Well, I suppose the general concept that we're talking about here is friction, which is obviously important for engineers. Yeah, I don't know. Who wants to talk about friction?
Well, I want to talk about air viscosity first. They scientifically and rigorously showed that at the levels of rotation that we are speaking of, the rate of rotation that we're speaking of, viscosity has a minimal effect. So this is all about surface roughness and the resulting friction of the one object on the other object.
Mm.
So if you have a rough surface, let's say just a normal tabletop without a Teflon coating, your friction on that surface is much higher. And that takes, that absorbs some of the energy from the rotation, which causes the object to rotate, you know, for a much shorter period before it falls. But now, if you use the Teflon coating and you have a smooth surface and you're reducing that friction, a lot more of your energy can remain within the rotational frame.
Okay.
And I have some numbers that they had a difference of 10 seconds on the show between the dry surface and adding the Vaseline to it.
So my question would be then, so what's the optimal surface for spinning on then?
Well, one with the lowest coefficient of friction. So, well, we should probably talk about what coefficient of friction is. So when you have dry friction, which is basically without, you know, two solid surfaces that are contacting each other, then you've got the way in which those surfaces slide, or they don't necessarily even have to slide, but basically the way that they interact will produce a force that will inhibit the motion of those two surfaces relative to one another. And that's what we call the frictional force that you get between two things. And there's a nice kind of linear relationship, actually, something called Coulomb's law.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of dry friction is also known as Coulomb friction, and it's that the frictional force is equal to, or less than or equal to, the coefficient of friction of those two surfaces multiplied by the normal force. So basically the kind of, you know, if you've got an object sitting on a table, that would be like the force due to gravity.
Yeah.
And so this coefficient of friction really is a material property. Teflon, for example, you might have a coefficient of friction of, say, 0.04,
mm-hmm.
compared to just a standard wooden table surface, which could be anything from about 0.25 to 0.5, depending on what kind of wood and how rough it is and what the surface finish is. So, yeah, Teflon has a lower mu, which means you're going to have less friction acting, which means, as Madeline said, less energy is going to be taken out of the system. I figured that there was a bit of a gap in the research here. Because they've done this experiment with Vaseline, but they hadn't tried it with Teflon. And obviously the people in Nature looked at different surfaces, including Teflon, but I figured they hadn't done Teflon for wedding rings. So, you know, my contribution to the literature. And I'll post these results up on the EdNerds website.
Yeah, can see weirdest fact. Yes. What did you do?
So because I love spinning my wedding ring, I span my wedding ring 10 times on a wooden surface. And then you can buy these kind of Teflon sheets that you use in cooking, in baking, basically, to, you know, basically non-stick sheets.
For doing your, like, snaps or whatever that you cook in the oven.
Parmesan.
Wafers? Crisps. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. The Teflon sheets.
So we had some of those kicking around the cupboard. So I thought, right, well, let's try it. Let's test the theory. I wasn't able to directly measure the coefficient of friction in the Teflon, although actually I suppose I could have, but I didn't. So I'm just going to assume that it was whatever the textbook numbers are, 0.04. And I was able to achieve a 6.5 second decrease on average in spin time. Sorry, increase in spin time between the wood and the Teflon. So I wasn't able to beat the 41 seconds in time of Conan O'Brien. My maximum spin time was 38.2 seconds. I actually filmed one of them, which I'll put I'll put the video up on the on the website for this episode. But anyway, that's what I spent some of my spare time doing.
You need help.
I've not decided when I'm going to submit a letter to Nature with the results.
This doesn't surprise me, given that I think you told me it was after last Christmas or something when you did the experiment with the frequency of cork popping.
Ah, that was a good one.
Measured using the iPhone and the FFT app or whatever it was.
Yeah. Any experiments you can do using your phone are always good fun.
Yeah.
You can measure the spinning rate of fidget spinners using a similar app.
I normally have the accelerometer on my phone when I'm on the train, because I like to see how fast the train is accelerating.
Friction is really important in engineering, and I was trying to think of some of the kind of applications of friction that are important in engineering terms, and there's like basically everything that you can think of to do with engineering, there's usually something to do with friction kind of incorporated into the design. It's just such a fundamental force. One question actually, so your car utilizes friction predominantly with the tires, so your car's moving. So firstly, what's the difference between kinetic friction and static friction? And secondly, if your car's moving, do the tyres have kinetic friction or static friction?
I guess if I jump into the obvious answer and say it's moving, so therefore it must be kinetic.
It'll have both, won't it?
Oh, because it's definitely not kinetic. It's more likely to be static, and although it probably is a combination of two, kind of. So
remind me what kinetic friction is, because this is something that I remember from undergraduate days, but I have never thought about it since.
Sure, yeah. So if you've got an object, say, on a table, and say it's a heavy object and you've got quite a rough surface, and you try and push it, then if it doesn't move, but you're still trying to apply a force to it and it's not moving, then that's static friction, which is stopping it from moving. As soon as it's moving, it's still friction between the object and the surface that's opposing the motion. That's now kinetic friction. And the main difference is that you still have kind of Coulomb's law applying, but the coefficients of friction change between when surfaces are static and when they're moving relative to one another.
So I guess with a car, if we assume that, you know, you're driving in a safe manner, that means that your tire's not sliding.
Yes.
Static friction is what is being applied, basically, isn't it? Because it's not...
Yeah, because instantaneously, as the wheel is rotating, the contact patch and the ground are not moving relative to one another, which is maybe a bit of a strange concept to think about. When you're speeding down the motorway, the relative speed between the ground and the tyre is zero at the contact patch.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, which means you have static friction. Until you slam your brakes on and you're trying to stop you quickly and your wheels lock up, and then it becomes kinetic friction. But then this is why ABS is important. So the coefficient of friction, kinetic friction between a tire and the road is lower than the static coefficient of friction between the tire and the road. So you want to try and stop your wheels locking up so that you have more friction so that you brake quicker.
No, I was going to say that's interesting because I think I remember having this debate as an undergraduate, and you know, the kind of intuitive argument that was put forward was, okay, if you have your wheels locked and you're skidding, surely that means the coefficient of friction is higher, which is better because you stop quicker, but it's not so good because you're not actually going to be in control and be able to steer.
Yeah, so that's actually
that's actually not true.
Yeah.
So the argument for ABS is that you're still in control and you can stop quicker because the coefficient of friction is higher for static friction than kinetic friction.
Yeah.
We are entering a dangerous driving time of the year because I'm hoping for snow soon. But I'm always hoping for snow. But that means that we will have black ice on the road.
Yeah.
So what is your recommendations for people how to drive in icy conditions safely?
Safely. Well, if you're actually in Europe, I don't know if it's all European countries, but I used to live in Germany, for example, and in the winter you have to fit winter tyres.
It's a legal requirement.
Yeah, it's a legal requirement, yeah. So that would be one.
I think, if you hit black ice, there's not a lot you can really do.
Yeah.
In your car, just, you know, don't hope that nothing all it is.
So the only thing you can do is try and avoid black ice or driving altogether.
Yeah, I mean... snow is one thing, ice is another.
I commute to work on my bike, and currently I'm thinking about how I'm gonna, what's going to happen when it starts snowing and stuff, because I've got quite skinny tyres on my bike. So I was looking up, actually, and you can buy bike tyres that have studs in them for... to basically so that they still work in ice.
So I think in the UK it's illegal for cars to be fitted with studded tyres.
It's illegal?
Yeah, because really? Ironically, and the reason it's illegal, ironically, is because of the damage it can potentially do to the road surface.
Yeah.
I mean, given the quality of our existing road surfaces at the moment, it's kind of irrelevant, really.
Right, so we're going to move on to our final fact of the show, and that is Craig's fact.
Yeah, so we kind of connect quite nicely into my fact, since we've just been kind of laterally talking about cars and whatnot. And my fact is around the use of ground-penetrating radar, or GPR, for helping guide autonomous vehicles.
So I promised at the start of the show that we were going to explain what ground-penetrating radar and GPR, what that was.
I've been waiting the whole of the Engineered series to talk about GPR.
And we had so much discussion on various topics to do with aerodynamics. So finally.
GPR, or ground-penetrating radar, that's a lot of what I do for my research. So to kind of explain briefly what GPR is, I felt... First of all, I should say that the ground part of penetrating radar is a bit of a misnomer, because although a lot of the applications of GPR are trying to look into and map the subsurface, it's used for many other things as well, where we're looking into infrastructure and buildings.
I was looking up a few different applications of GPR. I was quite surprised, actually, as to what, you know, some of the different things that can be used in, like, archaeology and geotechnics, forensic investigations.
Yeah, so the archaeology and the forensic bit are usually why it makes the news.
Yeah.
On the rare occasions you hear about GPR in the news, it's either some kind of grim forensic discovery.
I mean, I've got a note written down here that whilst there were lots of different applications in different areas, it's basically finding stuff that you can't see.
Yes.
Normally.
So that, yeah, that's kind of a good place to start kind of explaining what it is. So GPR essentially uses electromagnetic energy, pulses of electromagnetic energy, to image inside of objects that you can't visually see into. And what happens is that as that energy penetrates into an object, if it encounters any change in the electrical material properties inside the object, then that signal gets reflected and you can receive it again at the surface. And if you do that, if you scan your GPR system, you know, along the surface of the ground, let's say, or of a building or whatnot, then you can build up an image of what's inside.
And the fact that it's ground-penetrating radar, is that key to kind of the type of electromagnetic radiation that you use?
So it's typically because you want to be able to not only detect something, but you want to be able to tell the user something about at least the position of that object, and hopefully more about the material that it's made from. So that's where the sort of radar part comes in, because radar is an acronym for radio detection and ranging. So the ranging part is the telling you or determining the location. And to be able to do that, you need to basically send a broad spectrum of frequencies of electromagnetic energy into the object, because by sending that broad spectrum, you get a good resolution then of the objects inside.
But so I suppose it's like there's kind of similarities to things like X-rays and other kinds of.
There are many reasons why you would and wouldn't use X-rays, but you know, not least the kind of the health implications. But also, you know, to try and X-ray the side of a building would be an immensely challenging process.
Yeah.
But if you could, it would give you, you know, almost an optical image of what was inside, and that would be fantastic. The radar doesn't give you that. It gives you an image that you still have to kind of process and interpret to determine the geometry and the material properties of what you're looking at.
Mm.
This is used by the military quite a lot, because, you know, of its usefulness to determine exactly what is in a building.
Yes.
And if you want to secure your grounds, to make sure nobody is tunneling in underneath you. So if you have a map of the, you know, what is going on below your camp, or, you know, at different sections, then you can see is anyone maybe building a tunnel?
Yeah, exactly. And it was the military's use of GPR that kind of led to this autonomous vehicle application that we're kind of talking about. And that was basically to overcome the problem of trying to guide a vehicle either in poor weather conditions or where your GPS doesn't work so well, perhaps because it doesn't have a good line of sight to the sky. So the way of getting around that was to build a base map of the subsurface using GPR, and then when your autonomous vehicle is driving, it then compares the signal it's receiving from its own GPR with the base map that's already been recorded, and from that it can then determine its position.
It seemed to me like from what they were saying was that it would be an alternative to something like GPS. So you're not getting any information necessarily about your surroundings that you still have to get with another kind of system, like a LiDAR system or something, but that will very accurately tell you exactly where you are, kind of on a known, already mapped out grid, which is effectively what GPS tells you. And so, you know, if you couldn't necessarily do this with, GPS has accuracy issues, whereas this is kind of centimeter accuracy. And using something like LiDAR wouldn't necessarily work, because if one day, like, a building changes, not that the building would change position, but you know,
yeah, but this,
something changes in the scenery.
Landscape,
yeah,
might change, and that changes the whole picture.
Whereas it's much less likely that something underground is gonna change.
That's true, yeah, but that's also one of the sort of questions about the technique as well, is how susceptible it might be to changes in the ground. You know, less likely on kind of roads where you have a fairly impermeable surface, but you know, on a gravel road, for example, where after it rains, you know, your subsurface properties change then. Or in the city, when someone comes along and digs up the street to put in a cable, you need to remap the street then. So definitely some kind of challenges to think about this.
So I would say that the future of self-driving vehicles is maybe not just in one specific technology, but a variety of them. Yeah. Using ground penetrating radar and GPS and proximity sensors, and having all of this linked into a grid from which decision making can take place.
Does anyone know what the 6 levels of vehicle autonomy are? I say 6, sometimes people say there's 5. There's like a 0 level, which is what cars are at the moment, which is just not necessarily autonomous at all. So then you get level 1, which is some aspects of control, which quite a lot of cars have now, actually. So most cars are already at level 1 if you've got, say, cruise control, or some cars have, like, lane sensing type stuff, or some more recent cars maybe have automatic braking. So that would be level 1. Level 2 is when you can combine some of these things together. So maybe you can brake and swerve at the same time, or you can do cruise control and also lane control, which means, in theory, if you're going along the motorway, you could take your hands off the wheel.
So I've experienced like one of these things for the first time a few days ago, and we bought a new car that has adaptive cruise control.
Right.
Which
is where it...
So it senses the distance to the car in front and then adjusts your speed to maintain that distance.
So I think that would probably still count as a level 1. Because it's still one thing that you're controlling, which is your speed. So if you had that plus lane control, then in theory you can take your hand and your feet off the accelerator, and whilst you still have to be monitoring what's going on.
Are the levels of kind of human fear increasing as
well? Yeah, I guess so.
It depends on whether you are in the car or not. I saw a video a while ago of a car that parks itself. I think it was a BMW. And, you know, the person just climbs out, press the park button, and the car parks itself.
Mm.
So what's that, level 1 or level 2?
So that would count as a level 1, because it's something that's autonomous, but it's still only a 1 discrete maneuver. So then level 3 is... So level 3 is like level 2, but actually that's probably an argument. Maybe that would be more like a level 2 thing, actually.
Because it can control its speed.
Yeah, because you are doing speed and direction. Maybe that is a level 2. I mean, I don't know who sets these up and who's the arbiter of that. So level 3 is like level 2, but you don't require monitoring it. So basically you could go on the motorway, press a button, and you can turn away from the steering wheel.
I'm wincing at that prospect.
And really, actually, level 3 is when things like vehicle platoons, if anyone's heard of those, might start to happen, which is where you can have multiple vehicles stacked up behind one another in order to reduce drag. But really, you need a control system which is bulletproof, and so that you can follow another vehicle quite closely before that becomes a reality. Anyway, but that's something that I actually do research on at the moment. So level 4 is then fully autonomous, but in not every single driving scenario. So say most of the time you could be completely autonomous, but you couldn't, say, drive off road, or maybe there's a particular tricky roundabout or junction that you might have to handle sometimes, or a car parking situation that it couldn't handle. And then level 5 is literally fully autonomous. You don't have to do anything. Like, the car does everything. So the statement on whoever came up with these rules is that level 5 refers to a fully autonomous system that expects the vehicle's performance to equal that of a human driver in every driver scenario.
Mm. I wonder where we are generally at the moment. It feels like intuitively we're somewhere between 3 and 4, I would say. Maybe.
I think isolated vehicles are between... You might have the odd vehicle that might be up to kind of a level high level 3, low level 4 potentially. Most cars on the road are going to be level 1.
Yeah.
Because most cars will have some kind of adaptive control of some kind or control systems of some kind. And then probably higher end cars might have some level 2 stuff.
And I guess, you know, many countries are still trying to figure out what legislation they require to start to allow manufacturers that are developing autonomous vehicles to put them through, you know, to allow them on an actual road to, you know, to do more real world testing.
Yeah.
Because we've seen that, I think, in California.
Yeah, they've got...
There are cars have been given permission there to not to drive without a human being also being inside, but presumably to drive in a fully autonomous mode.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, you can go on like YouTube and stuff and you can see pictures of cars literally being driven around what looks like a normal, fairly busy road autonomously in places like California. Yeah. Obviously, like I said, with a person behind the wheel, just in case... looking out for, you know, stuff.
Yeah.
So they can press the red button whenever they want. But yeah. But I think kind of similar to how Formula One, in a way, acts as a kind of trickle down in terms of technology. I think one of the interesting things is things like autonomous racing. So there's something called RoboRace, which is a fully autonomous race vehicle platform, which is being developed at the moment. And they're basically looking to do Formula One, but without any drivers. So
hang on a minute. That to me makes no sense at all. I mean, it makes sense, I suppose, from the technological interest.
Yeah.
But as a sporting event, I'm not sure.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because part of Formula One's sporting... like interest is not just because of the drivers but because of the technical side of things, and then this is then kind of a fully technical, you know, no human intervention. Well, I say no human intervention, I mean obviously there's humans that have gone into designing the control systems, so you could say that there is some human aspect to it still, but yeah, no, it's an interesting one. I don't know I'm sure it's not going to overtake Formula One in terms of spectator numbers anytime soon.
Or if it is, it's going to be engine nerds like us who are its fan base.
Well, I'll put a link in the show notes so that all the other engine nerds out there can check it out. Okay, that's all we've got time for on this episode of Engine Nerds. If you want to get in touch with us about any of the crazy things that we've been talking about in this episode, you can do so via our Twitter handles. I'm on @NDMartin. Craig.
I'm @DrCraigWarren.
Madeline.
I'm @ML_Gombrink.
Or you can email us @enginenerds.co.uk or follow us @EngineNerdsUK on Twitter. Watch the space for an Engine Nerds Facebook page as well. You can find all of our previous episodes on our website, enginenerds.co.uk. That's it, so thanks for listening and goodbye. Bye.
Say
happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.